Hello and welcome back to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. Most of my guests on this podcast have had experience and success in either learning Chinese, teaching Chinese, or researching Chinese. Occasionally, though, I have the pleasure of interviewing guests with experience in all three, my recent episode with Ollie Linger being a perfect example of this. And today, I have the pleasure of interviewing another such guest. Rob Neal from the UK is the coordinator of SWIA, an organization that funds the teaching of Chinese in British state schools. He has over 20 years of experience engaging with the Chinese language, and recently completed his PhD at the University of Cambridge. His thesis asked a question that many learners and teachers have wondered about. How important is it for Mandarin learners to get the tones right? And his findings may surprise you. Okay, so Rob, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Misha. Great to be here.
So I wanted to start by asking you about why you started learning Chinese. I believe this was over 20 years. You've been engaged with the language for over 20 years now. So when was that and why was that?
Well, I did French and German at university, loved languages, spent a year abroad in France and Germany. And then I sort of wasn't quite ready to, as you say, settle down, get a proper job. So I wanted to explore Asia. I'd lived quite a Eurocentric life. And I went out to Japan for 2 years, actually, on this program called the JET program, which is, I think, Japan exchange teaching. Anyway, I was an English language assistant teacher in a school in Japan for 2 years, loved it. Visited China when I was in Japan, fell in love with China. It really blew my mind. I was only there for 4 or 5 days on my own, couldn't speak any Chinese, but thought, you know, I'm going to be back, and did a master's in applied linguistics, TESOL language teaching at Lancaster University, and then got a job at Beida, Beijing University, teaching English for 2.5 years. So that's when it really came alive, because I was living and working in China, completely immersed, although obviously speaking quite a lot of English when I was teaching, but on the streets of Beijing, you know, practicing my Chinese and having lots of Chinese lessons, 20 hours a week in the afternoons, and also practicing in the evenings and weekends as well. So that was 20 years ago now, but yeah, it blew my mind, and I've had a passion for China ever since.
So I'm just wondering if you could take us back to that time when you've made those first initial trips to China.
Yeah.
China's changed a lot since then, as everyone knows. What was China like back then? What were your first impressions of the place?
Well, it was exciting. I didn't really know what to expect. I landed late at night in Beijing, got a taxi. It seemed to be an awful long way from the city center. I ended up in some sort of youth hostel with lots of interesting people in a dorm, lots of smells and sights. And it just, you know, I was a tourist for 4 or 5 days. I remember that well, just doing the touristy thing, going to the Great Wall and just walking around and getting lost, and quite a few bicycles and things like that. But I suppose when I lived in Beijing, I had quite a privileged position, because I was given a room on the university campus in this building for the so-called foreign experts. So it was quite easy, you know, everything worked. But I just remember how, for a lad from Manchester, how exciting it was. It was deep in winter. It was about minus 10 during the day. It was particularly cold winter that year. In the summer, you know, 40 degrees. So you've got like a 60 degree difference between, you know, extreme temperature. And I had some lovely students from all over the country, and I traveled with some of them and visited them in their hometowns as well. So I got out of Beijing and really enjoyed getting out of a busy, smoggy, polluted city. Beijing's much nicer now in terms of air quality. I love going to the sort of rural parts of Sichuan or Gansu, Qinghai, way out west, as well as the big cities like Shanghai, Beijing. But it was just, everything seemed to be changing. There was lots of opportunities, lots and lots of mad traffic, lots and lots of interesting people doing great stuff. And there was this sort of sense of excitement about the future. So I think obviously the Olympics was 2008. So 2005, 2006, there were lots and lots of building works going on. Beijing was basically getting ready for the Olympics. Lots of new subway lines springing up left, right and centre. So it just felt really, really exciting to be part of that and to see it for myself.
I'm wondering, like, like 20 years later, obviously, you have been involved in kind of linguistics for a long time. You have like sophisticated ideas about the nature of language learning and that kind of thing. But back then, what was your kind of approach to that? You said you had some background that you'd enjoyed European languages when you were at school. But when you first arrived in China, when you first started taking on Chinese, did you have kind of sophisticated ideas going into it? Or what was your kind of outlook and approach to language learning at that initial stage?
Yeah, well, I just completed a master's in applied linguistics. So I had some ideas about the theory of language teaching and ideas about implicit versus explicit instruction I was quite interested in. But I must admit, I'm affected by, I think all teachers are, if they're honest, they're quite affected by how they learn languages and how they teach it. And I'm a bit of a grammar geek and I love my grammar and I'm very motivated. So I would be ducking into a Chinese textbook and looking at the grammar and just getting really excited by things like that, which is atypical. But equally, I did enjoy just total deep end immersion and just throw myself into it. I'm not shy about making mistakes or, you know, because I've had significant experience in other countries with other languages. So I love, you know, speaking and throwing myself in, as I say, whereas some of my friends, perhaps they focus more on characters and reading. And these are American friends I met, Japanese friends or even Korean friends in my language school. And perhaps they weren't, you know, I don't want to get into cultural stereotypes at all, but I was definitely weaker than my classmates in terms of reading and writing, but perhaps stronger in terms of speaking and listening. I did learn some sentences off by heart, and I just walked for miles and miles around Beijing at night listening to these sentences and practicing them. And that gave me some initial confidence. And then I'd used them in my daily life and get stuck into basic conversations. I think that is a good way to start. You know, obviously you can't just rely on chunks and just sound like a parrot. But I think once you've got maybe 300, 400 common sentences under your belt, and then you can see how they work and start spotting patterns and try to create new language for yourself, that's when your language can explode. But I was just so lucky, so blessed to have that opportunity because it was complete immersion. And, you know, I had to say, study in the classroom and then just practice outside the classroom with Chinese all around me. So, you know, if I hadn't made good progress, it would have been a bit disappointing.
I'm wondering whether at that point you noticed any differences between the challenges involved in learning Chinese versus the previous languages that you learned, the European ones.
Yeah, well, I think literacy, obviously reading and writing was a huge one, because with French and German, you know, you're using the same alphabet and there's lots of cognates and you can, you know, basically pick up Le Monde or Die Zeit, French or German newspaper, and understand, you know, 90%, 95% of what you're reading. Whereas those first few months, at least, or first year, 18 months, you know, I'm basically illiterate. I've got a few hundred characters and I'm practicing my characters, writing them out religiously, sat by the lake at Beijing University. But it's quite slow going. And I needed that buzz of just speaking with people and getting that feedback. So I think I definitely focus more on listening and speaking ahead of reading and writing. But in terms of, everyone goes on about the tones, of course they're important, but I think I felt it was more important to learn the rhythm, the intonation, the stress at the sentence level. And just, as I said, I was learning, memorizing these sentences off by heart on late night walks and practicing. And yes, Chinese people are very, very polite and they'd always compliment me on my tones and massage my ego. And I felt, you know, this is all right. I'm not going to worry too much about tones, but I did take accent in general very seriously. And there was lots of explicit practice and a lot of repetition. I think it was a Sony Walkman. It might've been an MP3 player or something, or an iPod or whatever they called then. But, you know, I was just walking around and repeating late at night and practicing. And I really enjoyed sort of the different accents from my Chinese students when we spoke Chinese. So we had people, as I said, from Henan or Sichuan, and they spoke very differently from the students from Beijing. And also the street vendors, the fruit sellers at Beidar, or the people that worked in the canteens who I talked to every day, you know, they were from all over China. And that was very, very interesting. So from an early starting point in my Chinese language learning career, you know, I was sensitized to all these different ways of saying things. And I sort of thought that actually this textbook Chinese that we learn with this beautiful Mandarin based on Beijing, but not quite the same, didn't necessarily exist that much in my daily life, my experience. And then obviously the local Beijing accent is very strong when you chat to taxi drivers or people in bars, you know, they're very, very, very pronounced. So I was interested in that, and I'd try and, you know, put on different accents as well, just to get a laugh from people, but also just show respect and make friends.
I want to talk more about accent in a moment and pronunciation, because that's something that I know that you've spent a lot of time thinking about. But I wanted to go back to an earlier point that you made, which was about chunking and some of the the initial methods that you used, you know, along the lines of sentence mining, listen and repeat methods and that kind of thing. And I've found that these methods are particularly effective for Chinese, maybe more so than other European languages, in the sense that once you've collected one sentence, you can very easily then change it into a different person. You don't have to worry about verb conjugations, genders, that kind of thing. And so from that perspective, it's particularly effective for Mandarin. But what I found is that not that many users learn those methods, but it sounds like from the beginning you were already doing that. What was the reason for that?
I think it was based on my previous language experience. So living in France for it wasn't quite a year, it was 6 months, but I used to keep a diary of new phrases and new sentences and write them down. It was almost not prefabricated chunks, but I'd try and use them in the future. And I was very interested in German idiomatic speech and proverbs and sayings, and had quite a collection. I used to annoy my French and German friends by just speaking in proverbs, and they would just all shut up and speak normally, please. But it was just a sort of joke we had going on. So I think I'd had that experience and I'd enjoyed it. I tried to join Beida's classes for foreigners, and one teacher kicked me out because I was a teacher. But another one felt was very nice and felt sorry for me. So I joined her class and basically just learned the textbook off by heart and the sentences and the conversations they were using, because they had a CD accompanying the course book. And I just found it useful, and it gave me that confidence to go out and, you know, it was all based on daily life and, you know, going shopping or whatever, buying a train ticket. But I think it's probably based on successful experience with French and German. I take your point about Chinese grammar perhaps being particularly helpful for this approach, just because, you know, we don't have verb endings and don't have to worry too much about articles and dead, das, and learn adjectival endings that I'd had with French and German. But I think it's an approach that works well in general for any language, personally.
So what was your progress like within that first year or couple of years living in that environment and learning Chinese?
Well, it was good. I mean, I had to, because it was literally sink or swim. And I'd have, for example, my parents came out to visit, my brother and a friend, a sister and a friend, you know, and I had to travel with them. And as soon as you get, or even in Beijing, you know, you have to use your Chinese ordering hotels or accommodation or train tickets or buying subway tickets, or, you know, it was just when you're forced to do something, it's obviously there's some terrible errors and mistakes, and, you know, some difficult moments when, you know, your phone breaks, but then you find some nice person who fixes it for about 20 kuai, you know, and it was just very real, you know. So you walk into the canteen and you're hungry, and you just have to point on day one and say, "Wei ao jiega, hai ao nega, duo xiao qian," that sort of thing, you know, from day one. And you remember these phrases because you need to use it. Or just walking into a hairdresser's and getting out my passport and showing them a photo of my hair and saying, you know, with very, very limited Chinese, as in literal complete beginners, it's remarkable what you can do when you have to. And it can be quite awkward for some days you just want to chill out and, you know, not hide, but you're being pushed out of your comfort zone. So I've been on buses. I do remember one of the first days that I had a friend at Beijing Normal University. So I'd been given the phrase in Chinese, like, "Wei ao qu bei shi da," I showed it to the person next to me, and, you know, within about 5 minutes, everyone on the bus knew that I was going to Beishadar, Beijing Normal University. And we got there and the whole bus told me to get off. You know, that's how you learn. It was successful. It's just, I feel sorry for these thousands of Chinese students who perhaps, you know, are ignored in Manchester and don't have those sort of experiences that I had. And maybe perhaps 20 years later with more foreigners in Beijing, perhaps you wouldn't have them so much now, I'm not sure, but it was just people were so encouraging and welcoming and helpful and appreciative of my efforts that I really buzzed off that. And I think it made a huge, well, in terms of motivation, it made a massive impact. And I could see that, yeah, it was useful. I was achieving what I wanted and I was using the language every day. So it was sort of ideal circumstances.
And how long did you stay living in China then?
It was about 2.5 years. I think I came in February 2004 and left at the end of June, early July 2006.
And then you went back to the UK?
Yeah, then I thought I was ready to, you know, get a job, as it were. So I did this thing called a PGCE, a Postgraduate Certificate of Education, trained to be a secondary school teacher. I went to the University of Sheffield because at that time, I think it was only Goldsmiths in London and Sheffield that offered a PGCE in Mandarin with other languages. And that was great. So I trained and I taught some beginners Chinese to sort of secondary, so that's 11 to 16 year olds, young people from Sheffield. And, you know, I felt it was really important because I've been so enriched by my time in China. China was obviously on the rise, and I just feel, you know, deep inside me that young people have to learn some basic Chinese and get an understanding of China and hopefully go out to China. And just, I wanted to share those experiences and try and, you know, it sounds a bit getting on my high horse, but sort of make a difference in young people's lives.
Absolutely. And one of the advantages, and this is something that I spoke about with a previous guest on a recent podcast, Ollie Linger, one of the advantages that teachers who have a background in having themselves learn Chinese as a foreign language is that you then have all that insight of what it was like for you to learn, the challenges you faced, and that can then kind of shape the way you teach the language. Was that your experience as well?
Yeah, I mean, I could empathize with students and think that's helpful, but equally there are gaps in my own professional knowledge because I've only spent 2.5 years there. You know, I think I did HSK3 in 2007 when I left. I'd like to think I'm way above that now, but I didn't have a formal degree in Chinese, but I did have very real experience. And, you know, I was fairly culturally, I was quite close to these kids, and I could empathize with, you know, their interests and hopefully bring the language alive in a meaningful way, so it's not this dry, academic, boring subject, which it could be perhaps. But I do think you need both. In an ideal scenario, you'd have a native teacher or a Chinese department at a school. You'd have a mixture of Chinese native speakers and European teachers who've learned Chinese as a second language.
I'm wondering as well, like, British people in general have a bad reputation when it comes to language learning and language and attitudes towards languages in general. What's the kind of response been from in general from the kids that you've taught to the Chinese language?
Yeah, I think is a huge, to be honest, a huge range. So you do have a few that have really, really gotten stuck into it. And then maybe I've had 5 or 6 students that have gone on to university now and done Chinese there, which is great. And we've had others that have given up quite quickly and just thought, no, this is too hard, it's not for me. But I think with Chinese, it is a bit more of a level playing field. So you've had students that might have been switched off from French or Spanish or German, but suddenly, wow, Chinese is really cool. And they've loved the characters and the sort of cracking the code element. And perhaps they've not been very good in terms of marks with French and German, but suddenly they find themselves near the top of the class in Chinese, and it's given them a massive lease of life. So that's been exciting too.
One of the reasons I was most interested in interviewing you was that you then went on to do some really interesting research, and you did a PhD on the subject of tones and how to teach tones, and we can talk a bit more about that in depth. But I'm wondering, how did that come about that you got into the research side of things?
Well, yeah, I think to be honest, I was getting a bit bored of teaching, and I spoke to my supervisor at Sheffield University, a guy called Mark Payne, and he'd done a PhD. He put me in touch with his tutor there, and it just took it from there. So it was a lovely for me, you know, to carry on teaching. I managed to get a scholarship, so I was teaching 3 days a week and doing the PhD 2 days a week. So it was a part time. It took 7 years in total. But I'd been thinking about this big questions about language learning and the differences perhaps between teaching Chinese with teaching English when I was at Beidar, or teaching French and German, because I was also doing that, and whether you need this sort of universal approach for all languages, regardless of which one, you can basically apply the same principles, or whether Chinese requires this specific Chinese pedagogy to take into account of the unique challenges like tones or characters. So that was my big question going in my head. And then obviously it has to narrow down. And I think it was on a summer course in Xi'an. And I was just chatting to one of my students. He's 14, first trip to China. And he was buzzing and just, I just love China. I'm having such a good time. And he just said out of the blue, "Sir, I just don't think tones are very important." I said, "Pardon?" And I was quite shocked because it didn't really come from me. And he goes, "Well, I think they're just going to understand anyway from the context, so it doesn't really matter." And it was just this little light bulb moment. And I thought, right, thank you. That is it. That is, I'm going to test your assumption out. And that became my PhD, basically, sort of how important are tones. Obviously, I didn't have the ideas then, but with, obviously reading and creating a literature review, I looked into pronunciation teaching, and I came across these scholars from Canada called Derwing and Munro, who'd done a lot of work on intelligibility. They also have this, which is basically actual understanding. Can you be understood? Do you understand what the person's trying to say? They also looked at accents, which is basically just difference. So are you speaking the same way that I'd say it? And they also looked at comprehensibility. How easy is it to understand? So does it require lots of effort? And so what I really wanted to look at was whether, because I was pretty sure you could be intelligible with dodgy tones, but how much that affected comprehensibility levels. So like how much effort did that require? So, you know, I started narrowing down research questions. I also wanted to look at awareness and how aware students were of their own pronunciation errors, because I think it is important to have some explicit knowledge and notice the gap between what you're trying to say and how a native speaker would say the same thing if you're keen to improve. And I also wanted to think about the nature of the pronunciation task. So obviously tone is going to be really important in individual words, but when you're speaking in sentences, when you've got sentence level context, perhaps they wouldn't be. So it was really practical, and it was motivated by my students. But I became, you know, obsessed by these questions for about 7 years. And you need to be obsessed to have the motivation to complete a PhD, because it is a huge investment of time and effort.
Absolutely. And so your PhD thesis, it took beginner learners and it tested the degree to which, you know, sentences and things they were saying were intelligible. What were your findings then by the end of it?
Okay, so I had about 40 Chinese postgrad students who were my raters, and I had 20 students from two different schools speaking Chinese and various tasks like individual words, role plays, sentence level reading. I randomized them and I got the Chinese raters to listen and write down what they thought they were trying to say, give them marks for accent, marks out for out of 9 for comprehensibility. Basically, there was a massive range between the students. So some had really good pronunciation, others were really, really weak. I think that all the learners were much more intelligible at the sentence level than the individual word level, which is quite obvious. I think it was quite surprising that most learners were most intelligible during role play activities, because in a way, you know, role plays is perhaps the most cognitively demanding of the three tasks, more than just reading aloud. But I think it was perhaps because they were speaking mainly in chunks, and that again gave them confidence, and they had this sort of ready-made intonation patterns. I found that they basically accent, comprehensibility, intelligibility are partially independent. So that means you could have a noticeable accent, but be completely intelligible and easy to understand. So I was arguing very much that it's okay to have an accent, because basically it's quite unrealistic to, on 2 hours a week and not living in China, to have this perfect native speaker accent. And as long as you're easy to understand, so highly comprehensible and completely intelligible, that's okay. So heavily accented tones didn't always lead to lower levels of comprehensibility and intelligibility. Sometimes they did, but actually a lot of the problems could be traced to individual words, which usually involve segmental sounds as well as tone. So for example, they might be trying to say something like and they'd say something like the rater might write nida zhongguo, and then it'd be blank. So shengri would be understood as zhongguo, which is obviously completely different and fairly disastrous. So my point was, yes, tones are important, but actually for these beginner learners, it's very important that we look at their segmental sounds as well as tone, and don't just put tones on a pedestal. And I think perhaps the most robust evidence was just their low levels of awareness of their own pronunciation errors. So they never really corrected themselves. And afterwards, I would play back and say, okay, this has been marked wrong by a native speaker. Can you tell me what you think the problem is and why? And it's, no, I can't say it sounds fine to me. Or, you know, so it seemed that there were clear sort of teaching implications for me in terms of raising awareness of their pronunciation errors as well. So there's lots of things, but it was a case study. So obviously I can't just apply all my findings to all young people learning Chinese. It was very much, these are my learners in a school in a city, Manchester, at the time. And I just wanted to write it up and start a conversation, because most of the research is carried out by university-based professors researching the Chinese of their own students who are adult learners who have chosen to do Chinese at university, who are very different from my students who are sort of 12, 13, 14 years old, who, you know, haven't necessarily had much experience of learning languages before.
One of the things that I remember I emailed to you when I was inviting you to come on this podcast was about how much your research and the findings resonated with my own personal experience when I was first learning Chinese, because I also sort of, very similar to the student that made the comment that inspired the research, I also felt at the beginning, you know, tones don't really matter that much because I can be understood. And one of the things I then subsequently found was that tones became more of an issue later on, because as you reach like intermediate and advanced stage, the things that you often want to say are less predictable than when you're at a beginner stage. So for native speakers, it's easier to predict what you might have meant if you mispronounce something with bad tones. But then later on, that can get a bit more difficult. And I think this is also something, it's kind of in line with something I've heard you mention. I was recently looking at a presentation that you did where you said pronunciation will not improve to any significant extent under conditions of exposure alone. So without some explicit knowledge of tones, it's not going to improve on its own. So I see a kind of issue here, because on the one hand, we don't want to put beginner learners off, and it is true to say that they can often be understood without tones. But at the same time, as you've said yourself, pronunciation isn't going to improve on its own. And I've also noticed that often the learners that have the best time with tones are the ones that, you know, get a really solid foundation from the beginning. So I'm wondering how we reconcile the fact that probably learning tones at the beginning pedagogically would mean that people had the easiest ride, but also might put people off.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it is a tightrope. It depends on the learners. It depends on their ultimate aims. It is hard with such limited curriculum time, so I'm talking 2 hours a week. But yeah, based on my research, I think you could have 10, 15 minutes explicit pronunciation guidance per week from day one. That would be helpful and important. I just think it's a sensible balance. And I think tones, of course, are important, but, you know, in daily life, perhaps 50% when Chinese people are speaking casually and quite quickly, you know, there's lots of atonal or effectively toneless syllables. And the danger of overemphasizing tones, ta shi zhong guo yuan, you sound like a robot. And it's much more useful. I think I'm getting this example from Jane Austen and Andrew Scrimgeour's book, but it's the sort of da 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 da, Tasha Jungoren. You know, that you're sort of teaching tones, but you're also teaching the rhythm and stress and intonation. So I think that would be really helpful from day one. And it's just getting a sensible balance, because if you're thinking too hard about tones, so for example, what do you do when you've got 4-3 tones or tone threes in a sentence? And it's very hard for the learner, and it's sort of this cognitive load, overload, and they're scared of opening their mouths. And even something simple as ni hao, and sort of saying, right, you've got 2/3 tones and the first one changes to a second tone and it's ni hao, you know, it's too much to think about. So in a way, yes, we have to just get this sensible balance, not ignore tones, but not ignore other things that are happening, and equally have lots of opportunity just to listen to Chinese without any demands to perform. So just listen to the flow in relaxed settings, and maybe outside the class as well with some basic films with subtitles or YouTube videos, that sort of thing can also be helpful. But if you've got learners that perhaps don't really want to do much outside the class and don't do too much homework, you know, it's going to be tricky. And we have to make Mandarin a mainstream subject for everyone, where everyone feels that they're getting at least something out of it and learning something. But you're right, it's important to start as a beginner. I think it's more successful to take tones and pronunciation seriously from day one. I think you're right that when language is very predictable, it's fairly obvious what you want to say. So therefore, tones and everything else isn't that important in terms of pronunciation. But when the language is less predictable, obviously, it is more important. But equally, I think there's this myth that, you know, once you have bad habits, your pronunciation gets fossilized and it's impossible to change. Well, I disagree. I think you can. It maybe requires a lot of effort, but I know you've been writing about your tone journey and sort of going back to things later, and actually your proof that, you know, you can do something about it. So there's sort of different routes to language learning. You can start with this very sort of, you know, declarative, explicit route, and then it becomes slowly like skill acquisition theory, proceduralized, becomes automatic. Or you could perhaps become a little, you know, start just throwing yourself into it, deep end, and then gradually you realize, well, actually, yeah, I would need some explicit guidance on where do I put my tongue in my mouth to make this sound. Oh, and then you're told, and it's sort of, oh, that's how you do it. And now I notice, and now I see. And I think both routes work well for different people. You could argue that they prefer different routes. But my point is, you need both sort of implicit and explicit, and a sensible balance makes an awful lot of sense.
Yeah, and one of the things you said that I really agree with is that, like, it really depends on the individual learner. And one thing I found is, in any language, there's always going to be a subset of people, and you alluded to this earlier, who are like really, really into it, like are really ambitious. They want to get like really good at this one language, whether it's Chinese, Spanish, whatever other language. In any classroom, there's always going to be that small subset of people. And what I found is that previously, in being in the position of one of those people, one of the main issues with tones was that most of my teachers at the beginning, they didn't have the knowledge I needed to tell me basically what I was supposed to do on my own. Because as you say, there's not really enough time in a classroom to spend all that time in a way that would be necessary to get someone's tones really well. It's something that people have to do on their own largely. But what I found was that a lot of the teachers I had didn't really know what to tell me when I asked them, like, if I want to get really good at tones, what specifically should I do? They kind of didn't have that knowledge. They weren't trained to impart that. Is that something you think is an issue as well?
Yeah, I do. And I think when I did my PGC, it was a great course, but we weren't taught much about pronunciation. I've thought a lot about it. And in a way, it's quite similar to teaching grammar. So it's this implicit, explicit debate. But I certainly think there's room for, you know, explicitly raising awareness of tonal issues in the class, just like you do with grammar mistakes. So, for example, a written homework, it's common at the start just to write 2 or 3 sentences on the board and say, can you spot the mistake in this sentence, just to to pick up a point, you know, maybe it's like word order. So for, I play football on Saturdays, wo xing qi liu qi zu chou. It's different in Chinese. And you write that on the board and you get the students to point it out, and that's fine. And you have to do that lots of times. But it's the same with tone. So you can, with the right class and with the right characters where people don't feel embarrassed and sort of learn from each other, you could record them and you say, okay, here's three sentences. Could anyone spot the pronunciation error in this sentence? What do you think? And just raise awareness of it. That happens very, very rarely in classes. Again, I think there's a limit to what we can do. We have to look at the, I'm teaching, you know, I'm preparing students for the GCSE exam. So you look at the mark scheme and it's basically quite sympathetic. I think the exact words are, can students be understood by a sympathetic native speaker? Which I take to mean they don't have to have a perfect accent, they just need to be intelligible. And maybe that's not that helpful in terms of if we were stricter and the exam criteria, the marking criteria was stricter, we'd take pronunciation a bit more seriously in the class. But it is often ignored because there's so much pressure to get through other things, and that's a shame. So I think my findings from my thesis was, let's take pronunciation more seriously, let's have 15-20 minutes explicit pronunciation teaching a week. However, let's do it in a way that is fun and motivating and not embarrassing for students. Or, you know, it's a tightrope. If you want to be a spy and work for MI6, you'll need to have perfect Chinese and perfect tones. So my point is, if you want to just go and work at Manchester Airport and serve tea and coffee for Chinese business people on their flights before their flights to Beijing, you won't need to have it. So we all have different needs and requirements when we learn a language, and it's being sensitive to the needs of our learners. But as you probably remember from school, I think you're much more motivated now to really improve your Chinese and your accent, get it up to really, really impressive levels. And that's fantastic, but that's got to come from you. It requires an awful lot of time and effort. And a good teacher should encourage you and give you some tips and advice for outside the classroom. But inside the classroom, I think we just have to focus on the most common pronunciation errors, and basically individualized instruction can happen outside.
And for those particularly ambitious students, if you have like students who like come to you and say like that they really want to get really good at this, that they want to make like Chinese the most important thing in their life, I'm sure like you've taught many students, you must have come across like some that are like that.
Yeah.
What do you think teachers should advise them specifically when it comes to this issue of tones and pronunciation?
Well, I think there's a lot of things you can do. Basically, outside the classroom, listening to native speakers in relaxed ways. I think the Karen Chung episode you had on echoing is very, very helpful. So sort of waiting, saying it in your mind first, and then repeating out aloud. I think shadowing, so using gestures is helpful as well. There's not much research on that, but actually when you speak, your hand movements, your gestures often help, and you do it subconsciously with the intonation, with the stress, with the rhythm. So having videos and watching Chinese people speaking and copying not just their pronunciation but their gestures can be helpful. I think finding strict language partners is helpful. You know, there are lots and lots of Chinese speakers in Manchester, including native speakers or families that, you know, moved over, or kids that have been born here but have excellent Chinese, or thousands of university students. So having Chinese friends is particularly helpful. One thing that was really motivating for my students was I recorded them speaking Chinese, and then I sent it out with their permission and their parents' permission to a teacher in Beijing, a friend of mine, who, you know, so it's like a partner school in Beijing, and his students could listen to my students speaking Chinese and try and write down what they were trying to say. and give them some feedback about their pronunciation. I mean, it's a lot of work for the teachers. It's quite intensive, but it was incredibly motivating for the English students to know that their work was being listened to by people their own age in China. So that was helpful too. But I think ultimately it's got to come from the students, and it's there's no substitute for individual work, and it's hard work. But I think I honestly think even if people talk about aptitude for pronunciation, and some people just find it naturally easy and they've got a real gift for it, I do think that even if you find it hard, with effort and commitment and time, anyone can make huge gains with their pronunciation, which is really encouraging. So it's not this impossible thing just for language geeks. It's completely doable. It just might take some people more effort than others.
Absolutely. Well, that's a really positive note to end on. So once again, thanks for sharing all of that with us. I'm sure that's been really beneficial to all our listeners, and really interesting to hear all about your research and experiences in China. So once again, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Misha.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter, run by me and my friend Will Hart. We share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter, and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.